You're listening to B Radio. I'm Ethan Ames Adams, your local news specialist for today. And with me are our international correspondent, Tony Olasanya.
Hiya.
And our foreign policy expert, Julia Cunningham.
Hi.
We'll be discussing some top news stories. And after that, we have a really interesting documentary on race and ethnicity for you.
Lidl's becomes the next supermarket to place a limit on purchasing of certain produce after recent extremities in weather conditions have ruined harvests abroad. Jemima Begum is prohibited from re-entering the UK as Special Immigration Appeal Commission denies her recent citizenship appeal. Despite the loss, her lawyers have said the legal fight is nowhere near over and they will continue to work until she is brought home.
In local news, according to Reading Police, a gang armed with machetes and samurai swords have been the cause of a public incident. Over the weekend, an incident was reported over a large group of people brandishing various weapons in the early morning of Friday the 24th. Although no injuries were involved, Reading Police are using the incident to grant additional policing powers. In international news, over 60 migrants have been found dead at the Italian coast after a shipwreck. It is believed that there could have been some 200 people on the boat coming from Turkey, and it is feared that more than 100 of those people have perished. Investigations have begun to identify the smugglers, while the search for more survivors continues.
And Slough has been named the fourth worst place to live in the UK in an online poll of more than 100,000 people. The results were released at the start of this month, and both Slough and Reading were shortlisted for the award of the worst place to live in the UK. And in sport, Tommy Fury has beaten Jake Paul in a blockbuster fight. The fight saw a split decision by the judges, and Fury described it as having consumed his life for the past 2 years. Fury had originally been scheduled to fight Paul in late 2021, but had to pull out due to medical issues.
Now, more on the unfolding migrant crisis in Italy. Over 60 migrants have been confirmed dead after a shipwreck carrying what is believed to be about 200 people. Of those people that have been found, over 12 of those victims were children and one infant. Italian Coast Guard are now on the search for four people believed to have orchestrated the failed smuggling attempt. This tragic event has come just days after Italy has implemented new laws to limit the level of migration, including limiting one humanitarian rescue boat to go out at one time.
This is a bit of a trend emerging in Europe, kind of regarding far-right parties and their electoral success. Do you think this is the first real-world consequence of that that we've seen?
I think a lot of the moves towards more xenophobic policies have been justified over the last few years, and we're really seeing what those kind of policies can do in real life and the tragic effect that can have on real people's lives.
I think you may have just said that they were justified in moving to xenophobic policies. I just want to clarify, you mean
no,
the
they've
fear
tried.
Is justified.
They've tried to justify it for a while now. But I think seeing this in real life just shows how antiquated those views are.
Yeah, of course.
And these are real life people we're talking about. 12 children and one infant, one 12-year-old boy, saw four of his siblings perish there, and his parents as well. These aren't just laws. These aren't just, you know, rules that they put in place. These are real people's lives, people who deserve to live, people who deserve a better life. And seeing as only one rescue ship can go out at once as a result of these views, so many more people are going to needlessly die because of it.
It's awful. So moving back to local news, the poll rating Slough as the fourth worst place to live in the UK. It's important to note that this was conducted through a satirical website. It's called I Live Here, and they report on a lot of the towns in the UK in a comedic manner. But nonetheless, the results are still voted for by real people. So I was going to dive into what the people of Reading think. I went out and asked them. But before I do that, I want to ask you guys, what do you guys think of Reading? I know we all live here or study here, so.
I have strong feelings about Reading. I commute, and I use the bus a lot. And I find that the bus is never there when you need it. I find that I'm often standing there waiting 20, 30 minutes. And even though I feel like it's a student bus, so it should be there at more reasonable times, but it never is. So I feel like maybe more buses, student buses at least.
I feel like that's a problem everywhere, though. And I wouldn't say that Reading is particularly at fault. I personally love Reading. I love coming to uni here. It really reminds me of home. I think the town centre is really pretty, especially at Christmas. Did you guys see it at Christmas?
I did.
I think it's a really lovely place. I was actually really surprised that it was even on the list of worst places to live. I know plenty of worst places to live. It's quite surprising to me. What do you think, Ethan?
Yeah, I mean, it's not without its faults, but I've enjoyed living here, studying here. So yeah, it did surprise me a lot. I can't say the same for Slough. I've not been there. So Julia,
I am from Slough. It's not the best.
Okay.
The only shopping centre we have is closing down. So, and our council is bankrupt. So if that gives you any idea of what Slough's like.
Yeah. Well, like I said, I went out in Reading and I asked some people what they thought, primarily about Reading, obviously, because we're in Reading. I did make sure they lived here and they weren't just visiting. So an older gentleman that I spoke to, he said that he'd lived here all his life, and he said that there used to be a lot of bowling alleys, swimming pools, other leisure facilities. He was particularly upset that these weren't as prominent as they used to be, and he kind of considered Reading just having nothing going on. He thought it was a pretty boring place to live. Another said that the roads were pretty terrible in Reading, and that they had been for a while. They also mentioned that the companies that had office buildings in Reading had been moving away, which left the buildings to be repurposed as flats. And this was something of a trend with the people I spoke to. Many people, even who lived in Reading, would say they just didn't really see it as much more of as a commuter town for London. And so primarily it kind of just had this aura of lacking identity, really. And for Slough, it's not too far away. I did ask a couple of people, but I didn't dive into it too much. And the people that I spoke to said that it had a reputation for being pretty unclean. And they said that when they went, there was just litter everywhere. And as you mentioned, Julia, the council had declared effective bankruptcy in 2021, with debts amassing up to £300 million.
£300 million?
Yeah. I mean, I shouldn't laugh. It's not great, but...
It's a lot for
a
council.
It does make you wonder, but hey, the repercussions of COVID, we can chalk it up to that.
I'm sure we can.
So this could be a reason for the decline in quality. And yes, this is probably very doom and gloom to listen to, but on the upshot, I think a lot of what people mentioned is pretty superficial. At least the people I spoke to, none of them mentioned like crime or unemployment or, you know, kind of more grandiose issues. It was sort of just quality of life things. But what do you guys think of Reading out there? Tweet us at B Radio. What's your favorite thing about Reading, or your least favorite thing? But let's try and keep it cheery. There's a bit too much doom and gloom in the world today.
Well, going back to doom and gloom, next I'm going back to the development of Shamima Begum, the woman who left the UK back in 2015 to join ISIS with two of her friends. 4 years later, age 19, she was then stripped of her British citizenship by the Home Secretary. Since then, Shamima's legal team has been providing compelling evidence of her being both groomed and trafficked. But the courts remain unconvinced, and just last week ruled against reinstating her citizenship. What do we think? Would you say this is a sensible claim the her lawyers have made?
I feel like it's a very controversial topic to cover.
It is.
I mean, I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. I don't know if anyone deserves to be stateless, but I feel like that's not a decision that I can make.
Yeah, I would say it's a strange predicament the way Shamima has been handled by the government. To make someone stateless is kind of acting beyond any sort of punishment I've seen for any other criminals in the past. So yes, while she has maybe committed crimes, legally speaking, it's definitely the case that she was groomed. Yes, people may say that she's still a national security risk, just because of what's happened. So I've heard people say that if she gets let back in the country and then does time in prison, there's no way to determine her loyalty or lack thereof post-prison sentence. So I get that, but at the same time, she's too young to be ascribed all the blame for her actions, or she was too young when she got taken out of the country. So yeah, it's a very contentious subject, but I think naturally her lawyers are one of the best have some of the best understanding of the situation, and I would be of the opinion that she was a product of grooming, and we can't really attribute strong blame directly at her.
Yeah, I do believe her lawyer's arguments are made on reasonable grounds. This obviously foreshadows what we'll discuss later, but children are very impressionable. Shamima said that a majority of the media content she was consuming at 15 was ISIS propaganda coming from religious extremists. And if that's the only ideology you're being bombarded with and you're constantly being told it's right, eventually you will believe it, especially if her friends believed it too, which is, I think, something people overlook when they question the thought process behind her actions. As a collective, they were likely all reinforcing the same beliefs in each other. So not only was she facing this in the media, but in person too. And psychological studies into conditioning have proven time and time again that if you reinforce a behavior enough, beings can be conditioned into doing a lot, like Pavlov or Skinner with their animal studies, or Watson and Rayner when they conditioned a little boy into developing a phobia of a white rat, proving that human behavior is extremely malleable. And that latter study also furthers the idea Ethan will touch on in more detail later. But children in particular are very vulnerable, especially if it's the behavior of a child, as Ethan discussed later. So whilst I can appreciate...
Yeah, I agree. I think, as I mentioned to Tony earlier as well, perhaps this is part of a greater symptom of more far-right movements in the UK. I think especially post 2015 election, there was a strong turnout for the UKIP party, and we've seen the Conservatives shift towards that. And so we can't exclude the UK from this greater trend in the continent of far-right parties and xenophobia and anti-migrant status. Is that something you guys would agree with?
I would agree with that. But going back to Shamima, a lot of people have had the critique that she was likely too old to be acting the way that she did. However, by the standards of the UK law, I would say that she wasn't. You're legally an adult when you're 18. She was 15 years old. She was a child who was also under the legal age of consent. So as a British citizen, even if she was abroad, she couldn't have consented to marrying anybody, much less a 23-year-old man at age 15. I mean, legally, I don't understand how it can be disputed that she was groomed. And aside from that, I definitely think that race plays a big part in how she was treated. More specifically, I think there's an adultification bias here, which for those of you who don't know who are listening, basically means that when a person of colour is typically treated older than they are, which means that, constantly treated as older than they are. I mean, remember the black Hackney schoolgirl that was pulled out of an exam, then stripped and searched because they thought she had cannabis? She was degraded because she was seen as a calculated criminal as opposed to a child. And it can be argued that the same thing has happened to Shamima. Instead of viewing her as a child and questioning why she wasn't safeguarded or how it was so easy for her to leave the country, not only her, mind you, her two friends, they took the most extreme measures, branded her as a terrorist, and removed her citizenship. Even now, after she's openly expressed remorse, has even lost two children to her poor living conditions, and is in constant danger, she hasn't been offered much support at all, both by the government and the media. Meanwhile, last year, there was the 15-year-old white schoolgirl, Rhiannon Rudd, who not only admitted to being a white supremacist, but was found convening with an American neo-Nazi online and was downloading instructions to make a bomb. She had all the terror offences against her dropped in January on the ground that she was a victim of exploitation and grooming. The contrast between how both of these girls were treated majorly speaks for itself. So what do you think about that?
I think the approach that some could say that the approach that the government has had to this new case is actually quite commendable. I do think the way that Shamima was treated should be reviewed and properly looked at, but I do think the case with the 15-year-old girl from January shows that the government has changed their outlook on this, and it could say that maybe they're having a new approach to these kinds of situations where they recognise grooming and they're willing to do something about it.
But would you say that it's very convenient that they only recognise grooming now when the victim is a white individual?
I think it would be difficult to say, because extremism and terrorism isn't exactly something that comes up every day, I mean, hopefully every day in our society. I think when the case comes up, they just have to approach it. Although I do feel like there have been significant contributing factors as why Shamima was treated differently. I think if we look at it as a whole and how they are approaching situations now, I think this is a step in the right direction, but I do genuinely believe they should, if this is the way they're going to approach this one, they should go back with the same approach to Shamima's situation.
So just to clarify, you do agree with having her citizenship revoked?
No. I said I think they should review her situation. I don't believe anyone deserves to be stateless. I think that that's an unprecedented situation there. I don't even know what that would mean. I think they should look at the situation again, and I do think she should serve time, whatever the criminal punishment is. But I feel like she should do it here in England.
Yeah, and like you said, it's kind of convenient that the only time we've seen sort of a going back on the steps they took towards Shamima was with a white person. So it's yet to be seen whether the government really has learnt from their mistakes, because I believe it was the same party. It was a Conservative Party when she was made stateless. Yes. So we can't say, oh, they're, you know, have to learn from the mistakes of others. This is the same party, a lot of the same people, and yet it doesn't really seem like they've learned just yet. I mean, Shamima is still a big talking point. She's still relevant. It's not like they can sweep it under the rug and pretend that it never happened. So yeah, we need to see kind of more proof. Obviously, it's fortuitous that something like this hasn't happened again. There's no case of a child being taken out of the country and trying to regain entry, but we would need to see a person of colour receive the same treatment that this white girl has as of late.
And would you secure safety for her son at least?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, the son's completely innocent, and before she was made stateless, that's the son of a British national. So it's only because of the actions of this government that Shamima's been made stateless. Sorry, not this government, the former government that made that decision. That she's been made stateless, so we can't ascribe that same stateless attitude towards the completely innocent child just because he's the child of her.
Understood. Well, thank you for your contributions. Now stay with us as we next discuss race, ethnicity, and conditioning.
Do you think you have any preconceptions from your childhood? Have you ever noticed covert racism in the media you consume? Do you believe the shows you watch impact your beliefs? Perhaps after hearing our findings, you might change your mind.
Whether we admit it or not, the media plays a far greater role in our perceptions and opinions than we may think. Marxist approaches challenge the belief that the media, especially in the West, supposedly serves as a pluralist mechanism that can foster debate and criticism of those in power. For example, Chomsky often talked about the manufacturing of consent, which viewed media as a forum through which a belief system can be fabricated and enforced upon its consumers. The human mind is at its most malleable in infancy through to young adulthood, and so the effects of the media consumed at such an age on opinions and behaviour is far more acute. An effective study that aimed to demonstrate the suggestible nature of a child's mind was the famous Bobo doll study, which was carried out in the 60s by Albert Bandura. Essentially, a group of very young children between 3 and 5 were made to watch an adult treat this Bobo doll aggressively. It was something of a large, soft doll toy, similar to a punching bag, and the kids were then left alone with the doll after the adults were done with it. And what they found was that they would mimic these aggressive behaviours that the adults had exhibited towards the doll. So they would punch it, they would kick it, they'd yell at it. So the most clear thing from this study was that children are very suggestible, and they'll do exactly as others do, and inferably, especially when they observe figures of authorities like adults.
Couldn't you say that that was a manufactured study, where they wanted the children to hit the doll? Can it really reflect their true behaviour if they were specifically shown how to hit what already looked like a punching dummy?
I think that's definitely a point worth mentioning. If you look at the methods they use in that study, there's a part where they say that they actually took the toys away from the children. So they set them up with some toys before this and then took them away and told them that they couldn't play with these toys. And they actually say in their methods that this was done to increase frustration. So yes, this is definitely a simulated experience, but the implications of the results are still very important. So if you consider this in terms of race, if a child's so easily influencing their behavior towards a doll like that, how can their behavior be changed towards those of other races, you know, people that look different to them? This is something that was done in the doll experiments by Kenneth and Mamie Clark. So their study took place in the US and it had children of color as well as white children be presented with two dolls. They were given a doll that had Western beauty standards, so one with pale skin and blonde hair, and then one that was more of a minority appearance, so it had brown skin and black hair. They were then asked questions of the dolls. They were asked, would they like to play with it? Do they think it looked friendly? Do they like how it looks? Do they think it looks nice? And the results were really insightful because regardless of the race, the white doll had a clear preference. So initially, you may have expected that the white children prefer the white doll and the black children prefer the black doll. But in the society of the US, which was very segregated at the time, it demonstrated this internalized racism that the children had, even at the young age of five. After they found the results, they wrote that even a black child in America is aware that to be a person of color in American society is a mark of inferior status. So this is one of the first studies that highlighted internalized racism and showed the harmful effects of segregation on children. They actually went on to be witnesses for cases that would lead to the overturning of segregated education in Brown v. Board of Education. So the takeaway here is that, yes, while both of these studies are not explicitly concerning the media, there is a valuable truth on the impact of what children see and what they will go on to do and think. The Bobo doll experiment shows a very immediate reaction, but I think the more poignant one is the doll studies in the US, because it's crucial how they illustrate the conditioned beliefs the children of the time had about race, even as young as five. And that's something that is probably very difficult to convey, you know, a child's perception of race and racism. So if you consider that regarding the media, children today are going to be forming assumptions, learning behaviors, and arriving at false truths through what they consume.
And arguably, children today are exposed to more media than they ever have been before. And Ashley discusses this in the interview later, but the hours that children spend consuming media and engaging with pop culture increases every year. I was looking at this research on Statista that said in 2018, 3 to 4 year olds were spending 14 hours a week watching TV, 8.9 hours a week on the internet, and 6.2 hours gaming. And I can only imagine that numbers have risen since then.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a really good point. And as I said earlier, the kind of Marxist thought is that a lot of this media is really subversive. The stereotypes that it reinforces are very difficult to be conscious of, even in adulthood. So if you think of that from the perspective of a child, there's no way they're going to be able to counteract anything they are supposedly conscious of, but obviously they're not going to be conscious of any of these beliefs being forced on them. As you said, a lot of what I've just discussed was mentioned by Ashley in our upcoming interview, so she can shed some light through her real world experience of this issue.
And these children really do have these learned behaviours, and it doesn't have to be in ways that are as obvious as the taught behaviour in the Bobo doll study. These behaviours can be picked up through small and seemingly insignificant messages that children encounter as they're growing up. An example of these kinds of messages that kids will pick up is from something like the Harry Potter books. I don't know about you guys, but as I was growing up, we got these big reading lists, especially in later primary school. And almost consistently in these reading lists, Harry Potter was on the list. And they grabbed even more attention as the movies were coming out around the same time. So I'm sure a lot of the audience can relate. But have you ever noticed the serious racial and ethnic undertones that continue throughout the series? Here's an example. The ethnic characters' names throughout the series are cartoonishly stereotypical. One of the first black characters to be introduced throughout the series, his name is Kingsley Shacklebolt. I don't even have to say that that clearly relates to very harmful imagery. Another one being the only East Asian character to come up in any of the books, her name was Cho Chang. Another completely outlandish stereotype. And these might not seem so forthright, but they definitely leave a lasting impression on the audience, even if it's subconscious. but by far the worst are the goblins. For some context, the goblins are these underground creatures who hoard all of the money. Although it doesn't sound like a big deal, when you look at the images and the descriptions of these goblins, especially in the movies, you can see how it's pushing this anti-Semitic rhetoric. From the Star of David being on the floors of the banks, the money hoarding, and their descriptions of having hooked noses, these are consistent with anti-Semitic propaganda that are dog whistles of white supremacist conspiracy theories. That leads people into extreme prejudices, and in the most drastic of cases, influences people to commit hate-driven actions.
But then again, these are children's books, so can it not be argued that these are just silly names made for kids?
While I understand that that is a valid criticism of this kind of thought, these are real messages spoon-fed to children through the media that's created for them, so the effects really can't be ignored. Because regardless of the child's ages, they're still able to act out the kind of behaviours that they've learned. This can be seen in the survey I conducted, where 77% of all participants said that they had seen or experienced acts of racism performed by children, which certainly to me was quite a surprising statistic, especially when paired with the fact that 64% of participants said that they believe that the media, as in TV, movies, books, YouTube, music, is the most influential factor over children and their behaviour in our modern era. So no, they're not just silly names in children's books. We see this constantly reflected as we move on to adult media, where these messages of covert racism continue. And a really well-researched example of this is the study that was done in 2017 by the Middle Eastern North African Arts Advocacy Coalition. In this study, they found that 92% of all scripted shows had absolutely no MENA representation. And among the very few that did, an astounding 78% of characters from Middle Eastern or North African descent were portrayed as trained terrorists, agents, soldiers, or tyrants. And it's a well-known fact that dealing with the stigma from terrorism and the portrayal of it in the media is a huge problem for people practicing Islam in the West. These kinds of media portrayals create prejudice in our minds, even if we don't necessarily realize it. This directly correlates to what is known as the hypodermic syringe model. Credited to Harold Laswell, the hypodermic syringe model suggests that the media has a direct and powerful influence on its audience. So imagine there's this giant syringe, and the contents within the syringe are the messages that the media wants to send us. And the syringe itself is the different forms of media that we consume. So when we read books, watch television, read the news, those messages are directly injected into our minds. This means that we as the audience have no choice but to passively accept the messages that the media is trying to send to us. And we end up projecting this. This leads to unfair treatment, a negative perception of others, and worst of all, serious hate crimes. And that's just the tip of the iceberg of the impacts that covert racism in the media can have. And I'm sure it's because of the reality of this situation that when asked, do you think it's important to have accurate representation for all groups in the media, that 100% of the participants said yes.
So as we've gathered so far, the media has a history of racial bias against people of colour. But for a more recent example, we can look at the Jeffrey Dahmer TV show that was released on Netflix. The show has sparked some controversy on social media, with some people questioning the contrasting reception people of colour criminals receive in comparison to their white counterparts. Whether this was done intentionally or not, the reception of the TV show heavily suggested that Dahmer was both glorified and humanised within it. So, I've picked out a few key ways I think could support that claim. First of all, the creation of the TV show as a whole. Even though there have been countless documentaries and shows made about Dahmer in the past, what was supposed to set this one apart was the fact that each episode was mostly from the perspective of the victims. But at the end of the day, it is still about him. He is the reoccurring presence in every single episode, the person who will stick in the audience's mind the most, and essentially the star of it all. Which to me is a form of glorification, because his actions were broadcasted on a humongous platform as if he had done something amazing. On top of that, the show was a massive success. It had over 196.2 million views within the first week of its release. And Evan Peters even won a Golden Globe
for playing Dharma. Once again, these are big accomplishments achieved by a TV show that he is the star of. The next issue is the casting. Again, intentionally or not, when looking at the reception of the show, I do think that the decision to cast Evan Peters led at least a portion of the audience to humanize Dharma. For context, Evan Peters is most known for his time on the TV show American Horror Story, in which he has played multiple prominent roles in most of the 10 seasons. And judging by the amount of support he has on social media, he has cultivated quite a strong fan base. It's speculated that a lot of these fans have formed a parasocial attachment to the actor, which according to the board-certified psychiatrist Dr. Gregory Brown, has become increasingly more common due to COVID and the loneliness in lockdown. Because of this attachment and pre-existing love for the actor, when they watch a show like Dharma, they're more likely to express sympathy and empathy towards the character just by association, which in the end leads to humanizing him. Especially because there were certain narratives and scenes in the show that would naturally elicit responses of sympathy, such as this narrative that Dharma had trauma surrounding abandonment and rejection because of his drug addict mother and often absent father. And of course, that is something a lot of people can relate to. Now, I know this sounds very controversial, and it's a controversial argument to make, but would you guys say that this concept or theory is plausible?
Yeah, I would have said that's definitely plausible anyway. But I think the point you made about COVID and lockdown makes it even more important. I think people become very attached to people they like to see on TV and in film. And the people they play doesn't really change the fact that they're still their favourite actor portraying that role.
And Tony?
I think it's very plausible, actually. Fan bases are a huge driving force behind the success of many of these shows. An example I can think of is when Zac Efron, who has a massive fan base, when he played Ted Bundy in the Ted Bundy series on Netflix.
I actually also want your opinions on this scene, in particular in the Dharma TV show. So there's this one episode with Tony Hughes, the both deaf and mute victim, where he's just spent the night with Dharma, then he goes to leave for work. Dharma panics, thinking he's being abandoned again, so he grabs a hammer and hides it behind his back with the intention of killing Tony. But then Tony hands him a note that says, "I won't disappear," and Dharma lets him go. Do you think alluding to his mental health was used as a cushion of sorts to soften the blow of what Dharma did?
I think trying to draw sympathy in any way to a serial killer was definitely quite distasteful by the producers of the show, because it makes him look more vulnerable and easy to feel sorry for. So...
yeah, I agree. I think trying to sympathize with someone who did so many awful things is, yeah, distasteful, as Tony said. And this is a kind of conjecture on my part, but it's difficult to picture that happening for a person of color. As you said, it's quite convenient that it's a white man being presented so favorably.
Definitely. And as a collective, I feel like this furthers the narrative that he wasn't responsible for his actions. Like, the urge to kill was out of his hands because of his past trauma and mental health issues. And this is exactly what a significant amount of people were saying on social media. Now, just to reiterate, I'm not saying that this was intentional, but hypothetically speaking, if it was, it would beg the question, why? What is the benefit of portraying Dharma like this? And the answer to a Marxist would likely be as simplistic as profit and upholding the privilege present in the structures of our society. Ralph Miliband occasionally argued this idea of the instrumental approach, which refers to how people in positions of power within media institutions can have influence over the media they put out, and their workers will succumb to the structures that keep them wealthy to avoid losing their jobs. White privilege is a very real part of that structure, so at least according to a Marxist, maybe the glorified portrayal of Dharma was also directly influenced.
Regarding the casting of Evan Peters, could you not say that the pool of actors that look convincingly like Jeffrey Dahmer is pretty small, and that the creators of the show just believed Evan Peters was the best choice for the role?
Whilst that is true, I feel like there is a pattern of behaviour here that would suggest otherwise. As Tony said, Zac Efron was casted to play Ted Bundy in the movie about him, and Ross Lynch to play Dahmer in yet another dramatised film. The common denominator between all of these men is that they have strong fan bases that find them attractive and admire them. And to some people, this critique might sound very far-fetched, but there was actually a study done by Muller in 2013 in which she found that the more attractive you perceive someone to be, the more you empathize with them. And to look at the larger effect of media like this, the cultivation theory says that being consistently exposed to repetitive messages in the media can influence an individual's perception of reality. Meaning, so long as there are these racist undertones in the media we consume, people will continue to be conditioned into having this perception of white individuals being more inherently innocent than their people of color counterparts. Because whilst Dahmer's legacy is consistently given platforms to be glorified on, this treatment is hardly ever given to people of color. I mean, going back to Shamima, of course their crimes are completely different, but in my opinion, his was worse. Yet I have actually seen more people sympathizing with him as opposed to her. And this conditioning and glorification not only has all the effects mentioned above, but can also normalize this behavior to a wider audience. For example, the woman who had pictures of Dahmer hung up in her house evidently glorified what he did and then murdered her boyfriend. Or the 21-year-old Dahmer fan who was planning on kidnapping, murdering, and committing cannibalistic offenses against gay men. This glorification has wider implications that extend beyond exclusively impacting people of color.
Thanks a lot, Julia. So that concludes our research into this topic, and we're now going to move on to our interview with Ashley.
Today we're joined by Ashley, a local primary school teacher here to discuss the effects of racially biased media on children.
So Ashley, first question, what are the ages of the students that you teach?
So currently I'm a student teacher. I work between Key Stages 1 and 2. I've just finished my second placement, which is within Key Stage 2, so the students range from about 8 to 9.
Would you say that your students are aware of race?
So 100%, yeah. I think children notice race several years before adults actually want to talk about it, especially students who derive from like minority ethnic groups. Despite the idea that you to kind of think that you're taught racism, I believe that children can still innocently experience and understand what it's like to feel different or excluded in the classroom.
And in your opinion, do you think that the school system uses materials that include covert racism?
So I think because I've only been in there for like a specific amount of time, I have mixed reviews on what's available from what isn't. Mm-hmm. From what I have seen, I'm only able to speak on my experience, and I think they use resources, but again, it is limited. I think they use mainly books, and those books are written by authors who derive from BAME backgrounds. The books normally look at like experiences that a lot of Black people might encounter. They look at things like the topics that we'd consider to be more sensitive. I don't think there are enough discussions, but I think they do use books to combat the issues and to have discussions about race.
So, following from that, do you believe children are a product of their environment? And so, consuming those kind of things, do you think that has an impact on their perception?
Well, I mean, if we look back to Bronfenbrenner's theory of how students learn, students are directly impacted by their environment and the microsystem, which includes, like, their family. So the practices, rules, morals that their parents uphold are the things that they would have observed and would then apply to the classroom. So I'd 100% say, yeah, that children are directly an impact of their environment.
Are there some behaviours that you learnt at school?
Me, myself?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, like when you go to school, whatever you see someone else doing, you'll observe. It's like when they say that the vocabulary you use around your child, they'll most likely pick up and add to their vocabulary. I think it's the same with behaviors. So if you see someone doing a specific task and you observe that task, at some point you yourself will implement that. So in a sense, yeah.
And if you were given more freedom, what initiatives would you put in place to ensure less racial bias?
I think it'll start with books, like making sure that we're not just picking books that focus on the trauma side of the Black Lives Matter movements and stuff like that. I want us to look at more positive outcomes, looking at trailblazers, looking at books that speak about our impacts on the environment, looking at having assemblies maybe to speak about equality and not just throwing a book in to combat the issue. I think it's also important for us to have conversations with students starting at an early age and not just waiting until they approach years 5 and year 6 where we start to have those conversations. I'd also look at getting students who are a part of like these BAME groups to come up and speak about their experiences because it's not too early to have these conversations. Look at art initiatives. In the classroom, you can use issue-based art to promote like anti-racist art. So maybe having art activities where students are given like a variety of colored papers to show who they are. Just looking at ways we can include racism in the classroom without waiting until the child gets to an older age. So yeah, books, art initiatives, having assemblies, having more discussions, stuff like that.
Being a younger teacher gives you the advantage of having gone through the school system relatively recently yourself. Would you say that the system you experienced was better or worse than it is now, and in what ways?
I think being from an area where predominantly all of my teachers were diverse allowed me to have a completely different impact, and it had a positive primary experience. I don't ever remember having conversations about race or anything along the lines of it, and I guess this is because my surroundings were all of a similar nature. However, as I got older and began to endeavor into higher studies, I began to experience a sense of racism when it came to approaching a higher level of study. So I think it kind of depends on where we are in the schooling. I think we have an opportunity, though, to more now than ever, to make the system better, because we have access to more resources. We have access to people and trailblazers who have made things better. And as a younger teacher, I think it's important for us to use the resources that we have at our hands now more than ever in the classroom.
Okay, and with that, do you think it has anything to do with the media?
Oh, 100%. I mean, I think anything a child sees online will eventually at some point come into their heads. It will be stuff that they apply. It's the same thing, like, if you look in the classroom now, more than ever we see children who are speaking about things that they've seen on TikTok, and they're now doing it in the classroom. So I think anything a child sees online, whether it's on television or on their phones, at some point they then use that in the classroom, which is why it's so important for us to kind of oversee what our children are doing at home, because safeguarding is really important for ensuring that your child is not viewing things that are without of their realms.
So even at that young age, would you say that your students are engaging in pop culture quite frequently?
100%. I mean, I'm in Key Stage 2, so these students are about year 5, year 6, so they have access to phones, and they're always talking about the things that they've seen online or what games they've been playing. So I think they definitely have exposure to what's at hand.
And with the increase of representation in the media, for example, the New Little Mermaid adaptation, is diverse media important for young children, and why?
So I think diversity in media matters because it brings attention to an otherwise underrepresented communities, and it gives a voice to the otherwise voiceless. For this reason, diverse representation on television or in the media is critical for raising awareness, empowering individuals, and just simply expanding career opportunities for students who derive from underrepresented groups. If I think about it from a personal perspective, I think growing up in school, I was never able to see storybooks or movies that had Cinderellas that looked like me. So now just being able to have a movie like Ariel that has the main character being black, it's just really important for encouraging us to know, you know, we too can be anything we put our minds to. And I think it's important for us to have these stuff because for young ethnic minority children, this is important in encouraging them to be or do whatever they dream of. I definitely think the media is really important now because if we think back to the historical doll study where they had several students and they were shown two different dolls, one doll that represented like Western beauty standards and another doll that represented children from a BAME background, majority of the students all chose the doll that looked like the beauty standard because they thought that that doll was more appropriate, that doll looked better. But I think having media now that does represent people from BAME backgrounds allows students to see the beauty within themselves and to see that they too can, like I said earlier, become anything that they put their minds to.
Just going back for a second, you mentioned that you thought it was important for the media children are consuming to be controlled. So do you believe the media children consume should be more stringently regulated in order to avoid them being conditioned to accept certain beliefs?
Yeah, to some extent, I think we should safeguard what children are doing on the internet because, as we mentioned earlier, the child's like behaviors, rules, and morals are all going to be highly influenced by what they see on the media. But at the same time, I think it's important for us to allow children to be exposed to these topics because it's important that we don't shelter our children. And like as we spoke about earlier, students understand what racism is because within the curriculum, at some point, you will feel excluded or you just simply feel like you don't fit in. So we should allow our children to be exposed to different topics while still monitoring what they see and do on the internet.
Before, you referred to how it's important for children from BAME communities to feel themselves reflected in the media. Do you feel like when you were younger, you were damaged by the conditioning from the media in thinking about, you know, diversity and how you were represented?
I think it varies in a sense where, of course, I had supportive parents at home who made me feel sure that I was beautiful in my skin. But at the same time, as a kid, you know, when you watch TV or when you see books and movies all showing one particular type, you begin to question yourself and your worth. So I think growing up, at some point, I did feel like maybe I just simply wasn't enough. But I did have parents who did a good job in ensuring that we had discussions about race and that my queries and concerns were not just shunned. I also think that they ensured that at an early age I was able to discuss sensitive topics, and despite these topics being sensitive, the conversation was always had in my house about the awareness of knowing that although we might not be seen in books or TV, we're still important.
So you believe that a lot of the issues with the damaging conditioning that children are going through, do you believe that it is important to fight it at home as well?
Yeah, I think it's important for you to have these conversations with your child, because again, we can't just depend on what we see online or what we see in books. We as parents have to take up a step to have conversations with our kids and to ensure that they understand what these sensitive topics entail.
Also, so these are obviously very sensitive topics to discuss with a child. Do you have any ways in which you would go about that?
I think it's important for us to understand that although kids are very innocent in a sense when we come to the topic of racism, they aren't ignorant towards it. They understand what it means to feel excluded or to just not feel a part of a group. So I think one way to have a conversation with your child about racism or in the classroom would be to use storybooks that touch on these sensitive topics. There are several books like Daddy Do My Hair, Look Up, different books that all cover the idea of what it's like to feel excluded within a classroom, within an institution, or just generally within the world. And I think if you use storybooks or shows that have predominantly BAME characters at the forefront, or if you use art, you can help to introduce the child to the aspect of racism and what it's like and how you can combat the issue.
As of September 2022, Reading is now the second most diverse place in the UK, with over 35% of the population being ethnically diverse. Would you say that the school system is doing an adequate amount to reflect this?
I think there's definitely been some initiatives to support this, and the school is doing what they can. I think it's important for us to realise that we can't change an entire school system overnight, so we should commend where praise is due and give recommendations as we see needs be. The school has created initiatives run by ethnic students to promote a sense of acceptance and belonging, and they've also done what they could do to have events that support ethnic students around times like Black History Month. It isn't perfect, but it's a step in the right direction. Of course, there is always room for improvement, and I think it comes to the point where ethnic students have to stand up and make recommendations, because change is inevitable and it can't be done unless we say something.
And do you find that 35% statistic in any way surprising?
Slightly, yes, because if I look at it from a personal aspect and just think about it from the course that I'm in, I'm the only Black girl / international student on my entire course. So to some extent, it is a bit weird for me to hear that we are 35% ethnically diverse. Despite this, I am aware that Reading has a lot of diverse people from different backgrounds, and it's just based maybe on the area that I live in.
So finally, do you think that education is moving in the right direction, and are you hopeful for the future?
100%, I think we're moving in the right direction, and I think with teachers like myself who aspire to inspire, it's only going to get better from here on out. I think teachers are now finding ways to be more inclusive in the classroom, we're using the right resources, and if we continue in this direction, then there will be nothing but the best for our students. I think as long as we are having open minds and we're using the resources that are at our hands, our students can look forward to a great education and a society that is inclusive, accessible, and adaptable.
Thank you so much, Ashley. This was a really wonderful, wonderful interview.
Thank you so much for having
me. Thank you.
Thank you.
So, do you think you have any preconceptions from your childhood? Have you ever noticed covert racism in the media you consume? Do you believe the shows you watch impact your belief? Now that we've finished, think about your answers again. Thank you so much for listening. I've been Tony Olasanya.
I've been Julia Cunningham.
And I've been Ethan Ames Adams. Thank you very much.